I'd like to have our guests introduce themselves a little bit and talk a little bit about your jobs in fire management, how you got into that sort of work, and from there we can go into what was happening this summer. And Howie, we'll start with you.
All right. Well, as far as my fire background, I've been in wildland fire for 28 years now, just completing the 28th fire season here, a pretty historic one for the Kenai. But I started my career at the age of 18, right out of high school, and got in wildland fire. It was a very exciting job, and as things progressed, worked my way into a management position. And so for the last 17 years of my 28-year career, I've been in a fire management officer role, doing fire all over the country, everywhere from the Southeast and down in Texas to New Mexico, Arizona, California, all the Western right. states, and then, of course, Alaska. And then took a fire position up here on the Kenai in 2010 as a fire management officer. And my day-to-day job is mostly overseeing the suppression operations. We have Helitech crews. We have engine crews, both here in Soldotna, and then also a field station in Homer. And, of course, a lot of our fire department cooperators out there, too, that help us with the work that we do in the summer. So, in a nutshell, that's my job is kind of behind the scenes, helping to make decisions to help support our guys in the field that are really at the end of the hose and on the end of the tools that are doing the work.
That are doing the work, yeah. Right. And Christy Bullock, a similar kind of a position within the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about what that job entails and what you do.
Sure. So I got into fire in 1993. So this is my 27th year. It's actually my last year of fire. This is my retirement year. So Swan Lake Fire is the last.
This is the swan song, as it were, right?
Yes, there has been that joke. There has been that.
Darn, I was, of course not.
So pretty similar. I started with on an engine crew and then worked on hand crews. Mostly in the Southwest, started in the Southwest, and then moved to California, took a little bit more advanced position back to the Southwest and the Southeast. You know, I've pretty much figured I've lived in every Western state and have worked on fires in every Western state in the lower 48, and then came up to Alaska for the first time in 2000 when the Alaska Interagency Management Team transitioned with me as the incident commander. For a fire I had in Idaho. So I was pretty much recruited to come up and have been fortunate to be up here working for Alaska Fire Service early 2000s and then with the Park Service. Back down to the lower 48 and then came back to Alaska in 2009 as a fire management officer living in McGrath, representing the southwestern area refuges. And right now I represent the southern area refuges, which include Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, as well as Kodiak Refuge, Togiak, and Yukon Delta. It's a little chunk of land. It's about 30 million acres.
You're right.
So basically, my staff of four, there's four permanent and one term position that we have currently. And what we do is we, for all of those refuges, we represent the refuge management. What we do is ensure that whatever is found in our land use planning documents, our comprehensive conservation plans, is in our fire management plans. And then we work directly with it's called the jurisdictional fire management officer. And I work with the protecting agency officers, which is what Howie is, just to represent our refuge managers.
Mm-hmm. Because as we know, the refuge is so much land of the Kenai Peninsula is refuge land. And so it's important that all of these agencies have communications and are working together. And we'll get into some of those relationships and how those different partnerships work. In talking about the Swan Lake Fire, I wanted to go back to before the fire started. Christy, you mentioned comprehensive plans. And I'm curious, going into the 2019 fire season, having some idea of what, trend conditions were and those sorts of things. What were the forecasts like going into the season? What were fire management officers and folks in your office, what were you looking out for, paying attention to, and things that would help you be able to respond to such an event? Because I don't know, how sure were we that there was a fire going to happen? I mean, it kind of felt like last year we knew it was dry, we knew it was hot, kind of almost only a matter of time, it seemed like.
Absolutely. In the off season, we do watch for trends on what weather and snowpack, et cetera, is doing. We have at our Geographical Area Coordination Center has a predictive services division, and we work closely with them to just look at seasonal outlooks. And the seasonal outlook actually for 2019 was average. Everything was saying average. So there wasn't anything later in June, so this is after the fire started.
Mm-hmm.
A new report came out that perhaps some of the temperatures and were going to be above average, and our relative humidities were going to be below average. But that's pretty much what we watch for, is what are the trends. One thing that my program does is we collect fuel moisture samples directly from the field, and that's on the northeast portion of Sterling is where our sampling site is. And I know Howie's going to talk about April a little bit, but the first sample that we took was in May. And in May, we found that the fuels, the very top layer was starting to be of the duff, which is the organic soils. The very top layer was starting to be a little bit dry based on temperature and relative humidity. However, just under the surface, it was pretty saturated, and that was due to our unusually wet weather that we had in May.
And Howie, fill us in a little bit on, because as Christy mentioned, you know, there's monitoring going on. Even right now, before we got into the studio this morning, we were talking about how, you know, there are different folks from the refuge or forestry that are out doing different things, and as they're out there, keeping an eye on stuff. So, yeah, tell us a little bit about some of the monitoring that goes in at the beginning of the season.
Well, like Christy said, you know, we look at what the predictive services has to give us as far as like what our seasonal outlook's going to be. And then really we're looking at how fast our snow is going away, you know, and typically by middle of April, you know, we're becoming snow free, what we consider snow free, which exposes all that grass that's out there. You know, we have a lot of grass, Calamagrossis, on the Kenai Peninsula, which is our main fire carrier in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, at that point in time, all the duff layers are still frozen and pretty saturated. So every fire we get is pretty much just a surface fire, and you know, that grass lights off pretty quickly. So,
and spreads really fast.
Really fast. And for April, we actually started, our first fire was, it occurred April 2nd. That was on Kodiak Island. So we had about a 1 acre fire there. And then, I think through the course of April, we had around 13 fires, which is above average for April, but not unheard of.
Yeah.
And then once we got into May, that was a little different story. We received record amounts of rainfall. You probably remember that.
Mm-hmm.
I know Anchorage was in that same boat, you know. So that rainfall happened all the way up until the end of May. And then we look at when the Swan Lake fire started June 5th, you know, it was a pretty fast turnaround on our weather that went from a rainy kind of ho-hum, you mm-hmm. know, sort of fire season per se to it escalated very quickly.
Right.
Our fuels can dry out really quick, you know, mm-hmm. within just a couple of days, our fine fuels. And of course, we kind of get into that, what we call the spring dip, and that's a phenomenon that happens with the black spruce, where their live fuel moisture drops down in about the 90% range or a little lower, which is very volatile for black spruce.
So. And I'm glad you brought that up. I'm curious about, you know, measuring certain fuel types, and in this fire in particular, and most fires on the Kenai Peninsula, black spruce is a very sort of central fuel source for, mm-hmm. for most of those fires. How do you take a look at those things? How do you go out and like tap trees and see how wet they are? How does that work?
Yeah, I'll probably let Christy speak to some of that because you know, we have done some joint fuel sampling work, but you know, the refuge has some of those tools to help do those factoring. So
in addition to measuring the duff moisture, which is the organic soils again moisture, we also do live fuel sampling. So we take some of the vegetation, we take clippings from black spruce, which is the most flammable of our tree species.
Gas on a stick, they call it, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. And so we take samples of that, and we dry them in an oven. And so we take a weight before we dry it, and then after we dry it. And then through the magic of math, we get a fuel moisture, and that live fuel moisture. We also take samples of shrubs. So we're looking at, you know, what's on the forest floor, so above the duff, what's on the forest floor that could become flammable. And as Howie alluded to, Calamagrostis, you know, when it's in its cured state after winter, that's extremely flammable. As it starts greening up, we also make note of that, you know, what percentage of the grass is green. And then that definitely will change as far as, you know, if you get a source of ignition such as a lightning strike or a human-caused ignition, you know, is the grass green enough where it's not going to take right away? But the trees, they're pretty much burnable almost year-round, yeah. Those black spruce are.
So I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but I am a little bit surprised to learn about how there are ways to sort of quantify, I guess, how flammable an area is. And that has to be some of the data that goes into, you know, when we drive down the highway and we see the how flammable or, you know, what is the fire danger? That's probably some of the data that goes into it is these fuel moisture measurements and some of these different, again, just sort of quantifications of how on fire things might be given. Yeah. This, that, or the other
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, that's correct. So when you see those fire danger signs, a lot of what we're doing is we're crunching those numbers in the morning for each of our weather stations. We have weather stations kind of scattered all over the peninsula, and they take readings. Once we get those things linked and up online in the spring after we see snow-free conditions, then those numbers start coming and are calibrated to kind of represent what the fuels are doing every day based on how much precip we get, what the temperatures are, the relative humidities, those kind of things all factor into all of those fire danger signs that you see out there. That's yeah. kind of the end result of where we start in the morning of doing those crunching those numbers to figure out where we're at for the day.
And is that a process that is sort of continually refined, or is it pretty dialed in as to what sort of measurements are needed and what sort of numbers are going to go into that sort of final? It's an interesting sort of visual presentation of a lot of different data.
Yeah. Yeah. They're set numbers. You know, we have ranges of numbers that kind of fall, you know, so, you know, in our fine fuel moistures might start at, you know, zero and go up to like 79 or whatever that is. And then from 80 to 85, you're looking at moderate. From 86 to 90, you're looking at high. And then, you know, kind of this chart, graduated chart mm-hmm. that kind of tells us where we're at, you know, yeah. any given day or any given time.
Yeah. And I should point out right now, as we're digging into the conversation this week, 283-8414 is the number. If you have a question about fire management operations here on the Kenai Peninsula, the Swan Lake Fire sort of in particular, we'd be glad to hear your call today. Again, 283-8414 is the number, 283-8414. Howie Kent with us this morning. He's a fire management officer with the State Division of Forestry. Also, Christy Bullock joining us in the studio this morning. She's the fire management officer at the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. And we were talking about some of the measurements and some of the observations going into the fire. And then, you know, June 5th comes along, a nice little thunderstorm out there. And I guess we were talking again before the show, talking about that first 24 hours of an event. And there's a bit of a scramble to just sort of wrap your arms around what's going on, what's the scope and degree of this event that's happening. Maybe you could walk us through sort of, you know, you get the call that there's a fire out there and sort of then what? Howie, maybe you could jump on that.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, when we get a fire call, you know, we have set determined response levels, I guess, if you want to call it that, predetermined. So we have four different options. There's a limited, which is kind of out away from values at risk. Mm-hmm. There's a modified, and then there's a full and a critical. And usually the full and critical are the areas where, you know, our residences are, our businesses are, you know, all anything that has, you know, significant value. Obviously, people are number one. Every fire, we look at the values and the people are always number one. So we determine where that fire is. You know, oftentimes we're utilizing aircraft to get our firefighters there to gather some information. We get a latitude longitude of where that fire is located, so we can plot it on the map accurately, and then we start working with our partners, you know, like Christy. She and I work a lot together because we have quite a few fires that happen on the refuge. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, every fire is looked at and what response we're going to take with that fire, given a number of factors. You know, available resources is one. And in the case of the Swan Lake fire, at that period of time, we haven't had a lightning bust where it started that many fires since 2005. We had eight fires that started that same evening, and we were fighting fire aggressively mm-hmm. in critical which where homes are at, in full protection, where we're on the fringes of where homes are at. So we look and prioritize our whatever we get for fire activity, from critical being number one, down to full, then modified, and then limited. But not to say that limited is not going to be looked at,
right?
Because in this case, we did send aircraft, and we got a good feel for what the fire was doing, what fuels it was in, how far away from communities or values at risk, and we did a full assessment, you know, and that's where we start having the conversation with our partners from the refuge and Christy and Andy there. So,
and this is the part of sort of the timeline of a fire and a fire response where the question comes up, okay, why didn't we put it out immediately? You know, and I'm sure that you guys get that question all the time. And Kent, you alluded to all the factors that go into that initial response and measuring for the long term, because as important as it is to protect people and property beyond that, then you start, I would imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, but then you start getting into, okay, what are the budget considerations of this and looking long term? You know, do we want to spend in June are what we've allotted or anticipate for our entire budget to maybe put out a fire that maybe there are parts of it that it wouldn't be so bad if it burned anyway. How have you addressed that question of how come it didn't get put out in June when it started, when it was relatively small?
Absolutely, I have been. So we were talking a little bit about myth busters, right? So one of the myths is that if a fire ignites in an area of limited, that's it. That's going to be how that fire is managed in its entirety, and that's just not true. The fire management options, as Howie talked about, are for basically the first 24 hours. When you're triaging fires, what are going to be the highest priority fires closest to the values at risk, which are homes and infrastructure? And so the fires that are farther away from town, and the Swan Lake specifically started about 8 miles northeast of Sterling. And the area that it started in was identified as limited protection for the reason that it was going to be a lower priority if we had some fires in full and critical, which did happen. So this particular fire started just outside a planned prescribed fire unit. So that prescribed fire unit was, we plan to initiate as soon as 2020, so as soon as next year. There were control lines in place for the prescribed fire. The prescribed fire would have been approximately 10,000 acres. And the purpose for the fire would be to remove large stands of fire-prone black spruce for the purpose of making a more fire-resilient landscape adjacent to the community of Sterling. Some other efforts had gone into doing that same thing before, and that's we do mechanical treatments.
Right.
Yeah, so the Sterling fuel break, and there's been some Refuge Notebook articles about that mm-hmm. in the Clarion. That was a cooperative effort. Everybody came to the table to create that Sterling fuel break for the purpose of making a change in vegetation in this continuous stand of black spruce, which is what the prescribed fire, if it were to be initiated, that was the same purpose of that, to provide fire resiliency to the communities, because fire really travels through black spruce. When you look at even Funny River Fire, when the Funny River Fire made its big runs, it was through the stands of contiguous black spruce. Mm-hmm. That's the primary carrier of fire. You know, once the grass greens up too, so grass certainly will carry, but grass is a little easier to put out than a large crown fire that you find in black spruce.
The grass fires are down on the ground. You can get resources on the ground and in front of them to a higher degree than when the black spruce stuff. I mean, I'm sure people saw the videos of folks driving along the Sterling Highway. And if you live in Funny River or Sterling area, you probably saw the smoke and even the flames and coming off of those fires in previous years. And it is incredibly dramatic to watch a fire go through a fuel source like we have so much of here on the Kenai Peninsula. And I wonder, you know, to what degree that sort of informs the public's reaction to actually see that, because it is very dramatic and it's kind of a hellscape coming at you. It can feel like it sometimes, you know, when it's kind of breathing down your neighborhood, as folks, you know, in Kenai Keys know all so well and several other areas. So we're talking about, I should reiterate the numbers here, 283-8414. If you'd like to give us a call, if you have questions about the Swan Lake Fire or the management operations thereof, speaking with Christy Bullock today from the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge and Howie Kent from the State Division of Forestry. And I want to stick with the fuel source here. Again, you know, we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of acres of black spruce. And maybe you could give us kind of an update on, you know, what's that fuel source like? What did this fire do to that? Taken in conjunction with fires, you know, the Card Street fire, the Funny River fire, maybe a broad picture of, you know, now how ripe is that area for fire, you know, sort of broadly the refuge and adjacent lands.
Well, the areas of black spruce that have been changed, it's a change of vegetation. So what we hope for with these large fires or small fires, even in areas of in wilderness and remote areas, not adjacent to values such as communities, but a little bit farther out from that, what we hope for is a mosaic burn. And that's the perfect world for us, because what that does is it changes the vegetation just enough so that the new lightning strike, once it hits, it's going to provide some changes in fire behavior. It's not going to be just this large scale fire that you had just painted the picture of that folks could see along the highway. So what we want to do is just create some sort of change so that when that fire, such as the Swan Lake fire, it didn't travel to the northwest because it hit a big open meadow. And these kinds of changes in what the fuel continuity is, those are going to make a difference for future wildfire response. And if you think about, you know, you did ask the question, why wasn't it put out? If you think about, if you've ever walked out into a black spruce forest and just seen how hard it is just to walk out there, now can you imagine a firefighter asking a firefighter to go right out in that and try to put a fire out? That's just not really fair. That's just too much firefighter exposure. And that, I know Howie would not ask his folks to go out there and do that. That doesn't work. Just doesn't work.
You know, we've seen many times where a ground fire burning in the grass transitions into a crown fire, climbs in the trees within a matter of seconds, you know. And, you know, what if the fire remains on the ground, we can attack that with people on the ground utilizing, you know, engines or hose lays, that kind of thing. As soon as it gets in the trees, we're talking a whole different ball game. The only way you're getting that out of the trees is by heavy aircraft, you know, heavy air tankers, scoopers that we saw this year and previous years on previous fires. So really it's a whole different, it's getting to a whole different realm. And safety is always our number one with our firefighter personnel and, of course, the public, you know.
So. I wanted to, you brought up the aircraft, and I wanted to get into some of the tools and some of the technology that was deployed in this fire. And air tankers is a good one to start. You know, I'm really curious. It seems, looking at it, you know, sort of a bird's eye view, it seems like, you know, what does that really do? It, you know, if you zoom out far enough, that's an itty bitty little airplane. It's a huge airplane, but it's an itty bitty little airplane picking up a couple spoonfuls of water and dropping them on a giant fire. What does that really do? Yeah. How, you know, what do you have to do to sort of pinpoint that and make those sorts of operations really effective?
Yeah, and that's why we have air attack group supervisors. You know, they're basically like what we would consider a division group supervisor, or somebody that's in charge of a section of fire that has that qualification, that they guide those aircraft, and they're mostly utilized along the perimeter. You know, they're trying to get that perimeter edge locked up, you know, so to speak, and contained so that fire doesn't progress, you know. So, you know, it's not just randomly or haphazardly dropping water all over the fire at different spots. It's very orchestrated and very, very direct, you know, on where they're going and what they're doing. Right on the perimeters is always where they're focusing.
When you're using those air water resources like that, is the goal to really cool down and get a specific area cold and more manageable, or is it to change the fire's direction, or what is the ultimate goal when you're putting those out there?
You're basically supporting firefighters on the ground, boots on the ground. That's really what you're doing. You're knocking the fire out of the trees so that it knocks it back to the ground, and then that is followed up by 20-person hand crews, whether it's hot shots or type 2 IA crews, which is initial attack, stands for initial attack, or just regular type 2 crews that come in and can help keep that fire on the ground and in check, and do some mop up, which when we say mop up, we're talking about, you know, deploying hose, or maybe we don't have water access, but you start dispersing and opening up those fuels to cool down so that they cannot build up again and torch trees out, which then create another crown fire.
And and this is that really intensive, as you said, boots on the ground work, shovels in the ground, overturning dirt, and making sure that that fire doesn't have anything to latch on to, you know, from where it's at to the next couple of feet down the projected path.
Yep, you're checking that fire up as you're going along. You know, a lot of you got 20 people out there with swinging tools, and they can put a hurt on a little section of fire. You know, they'll go a mile or so a day sometimes, depending on the ground and how easy it is, and the fuels that plays into productivity. But getting back to the aviation side, I mean, that is what those crews rely on. You know, when the fire activity is such that they can't get in there safely to face a fire that's in the trees like that. So,
you know, another part of the aviation point of this is the use of drones that perhaps it was here in years past, but this year it seemed to be quite prominent, and there were a lot and beyond just monitoring capabilities that you would at first assume a drone would be highly capable of, which they are, but actual attack strategies for, I think in this case, redirecting the fire or removing fuels ahead of the fire, those sorts of things. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how we're putting drones to use and how that whole operation we're at, because that's a whole other level of specialists and team members and information coming in that you have to do stuff with.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, that's really come on here in the last 3 years, I would say, the drone use. And in Alaska, you know, we should be proud. We're like kind of on the leading edge of this new drone era. Utilizing drones and training other people on how to utilize drones, but there's several different applications that we've seen on the drone use. Basically, everything from, you know, kind of surveillance to getting intel gathered. For some of these crews are carrying drones with them, so they can launch a drone up and they can see what the fire's doing. They can see where their water sources are. They can see what's out ahead of them and what kind of challenges they might run into, you know, with a change in fuel type or whatever. And then also, like you alluded to, there was some drone use in some aerial firing on specific points of the fire to help kind of shore things up, you know, along set containment lines and done in an orchestrated fashion to burn those fuels out more safely, as opposed to getting dictated to by a raging crown fire coming at you.
Or the wind or some other factor that you don't have control over, but you do have control over where it was the photos and the videos that were shown during the fire and during the public meetings about the fire showed like little ping pong balls full of jellied gasoline or some flammable substance of some sort that potassium manganate.
Yep, with glycol inserted, and that creates a chemical reaction that then lights those little ping pong balls on fire and hit the ground.
So you talked about how new this technology is. As fire management officers, I'm curious, you know, when you first see a technology like this deployed, what are the things you're going, we always wanted to have this information, or we always wanted to be able to do this, or what are some of the things that are on that kind of list?
Well, we looked at that early on, actually, in this fire, when the fire was making a run towards the Sterling Highway, just seeing, you know, what the power line, HEA's power line corridor looked like, you know, just what, you know, what our setback was there as far as like clearance and what the possibilities were for potentially doing a burnout operation off that line. So, you know, the drone was used there for just, you know, giving us intel on what kind of strategies we could put together to help attack this fire, keep this fire more in check. So,
well, and also, you know, in terms of monitoring and doing surveillance and those sorts of things, on days when it's too windy, too smoky to send up a helicopter, you can send up a drone.
Yep, they have infrared capabilities now. So, you know, where you can't fly a helicopter in those kind of smoky conditions, you can with a drone. You know, they've got these capabilities that are just unreal. And it's less exposure, you know, for live people in those aircraft. Now you're talking about an unmanned aircraft that can get you the same information at way less risk.
Yeah.
It can be used at night as well, which is pretty key. So just being able to be used, you know, that was one of the drawbacks of having helicopter operations only for aerial firing, And the aerial firing is used, if you think about a natural fuel break, such as the East Fork of the Moose River and Alphonse Lake and some of these areas that were on the southwest corner of the Swan Lake fire, which, of course, we did not want the fire to travel southwest. And indeed, it didn't. It was stopped at those natural and some pre-made barriers. There was a big fuel break that was conducted or created during the East Fork, the 2017 East Fork fire. And it was a large indirect line. And then refuge staff over the last couple of years had, we'd had improved that because we're going to use that as one of the control lines for the prescribed fire, planned prescribed fire. And so we can use aircraft to defend those natural or and man-made barriers. And then the drones can, even in the evening, at night, conduct aerial firing operations. So pretty cool.
Yeah, one more layer of being able to get data, one more layer of being able to conduct operations around the clock and help just help things move along. Hallie Kent joining us this morning, and Christy Bullock as well, fire management officers from the division, State Division of Forestry and Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, respectively. And we're to the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a little break here, get a refill of coffee. Of course, if you would like to jump in on the conversation this morning, have questions, thoughts about the Kenai, or excuse me, the Swan Lake fire that that happened and still is happening, smoldering a bit out there as we speak, despite some of that snow on the ground, give us a call during the second half of the program. 283-8414 is the number. Again, 283-8414. We're going to take a little bit of a break here at the bottom of the hour. Stay with us. And we're back with the Kenai Conversation this morning here on KDLL, talking about the Swan Lake Fire. Christy Bullock from the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, Howie Kent from the State Division of Forestry with us. And as we get to the second half of the program, looks like we have a call coming in. Good morning. Welcome to the conversation. Who's this?
Wenda Kennedy.
Hi, Wenda. Good morning. What's your question?
Wouldn't some more roads help in that area? I mean, there's no roads in that area, so I think that part of the problem is simply the lack of access.
Access to roads. Very good. Thanks for that call, Wenda. And that is a good point. And you know, a lot of the things that we saw this summer in terms of closures, in terms of recreational closures, were a lot of popular spots, trails that were used for access. Who wants to address, you know, issues with getting actual boots on the ground, perhaps where you'd like to get boots on the ground, where it's a challenge, and would roads help? How big of a challenge is it to develop a plan that includes things like that?
You know, I can touch on that, Shaylin. So there was the Mystery Creek Road, which was actively used by firefighters, as well as the NSTAR natural gas pipeline right away. So those two areas, the pipeline had been prepared and widened in preparation for the prescribed fire. The Mystery Creek Road, that road's been there for quite a while. It's used as access, and also it's opened seasonally for hunting and other activities. Both of those were used actively for management of the fire, and the fire was not able to be held at either, just because of extreme weather conditions. We had, if you remember, in July, we had temperatures in the 90s and relative humidities in the single digits, which, from what I have heard, has been record-breaking. That and an extended drought just created the perfect storm for fire behavior, which pretty much made it so that it didn't matter if you had 1,000 roads in there. The fire is going to travel in the areas of black spruce. And until that black spruce is, the continuity of it is removed. And fire really is the best mechanism to do that. We do mechanical treatments. They're between 2,000 to 10,000 an acre. We also we do prescribed fire, and which we are planned for that to reduce the black spruce. There just isn't an industry for black spruce. It's a fire-prone species. It's habitat. There's animals that rely on black spruce, and there's also animals that rely on deciduous vegetation next to black spruce. So, you know, that area is specifically for habitat, and also recreational users do go out there, you know, and they appreciate the wilderness side of that, you know, that particular area. There's other areas on the peninsula that folks can enjoy that have roads.
Well, part of the access question, I think, you know, when you're talking about things in the refuge, the part of the purpose of a refuge is to not really do anything to it. And sort of to the degree that you can and to the degree that it's possible, given, you know, who lives in it and around it, to just let things happen the way they're going to happen. And especially when we talk about a lightning caused fire, I know that over the years, fire managers have learned that it's healthier in a lot of cases to let those do their thing to the degree, again, that you can. And that's where the rubber hits the road, and that's where all the decisions are made, is what is that degree to which you can or can't do something, for sure. And access, I'm sure, I don't know, as seasons move along, and perhaps maybe, I don't want to sound grim about it, but, you know, honestly, as more of the refuge burns, some of those questions become, you know, not so important, because, you know, more and more areas have just been subjected to big fires, and so there's less to worry about kind of as the years go on. Or maybe that's an oversimplification, or I'm just being too hopeful about that and not wanting to cover more of these fires summer after summer. I think there's a question in there. Maybe not. If you have a question, give us a call. 283-8414 is the number. Again, 283-8414. Again, speaking this morning with Christy Bullock from the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, Howie Kent from the State Division of Forestry. You know, we were talking about, the fact that not planning for this fire in particular, but planning for fire starts in the spring. We're now in the winter, and as we mentioned earlier in the show, you know, the Swan Lake fire is still active. It's still out there and sort of doing its thing, despite we just got an update on 8 inches of snow out by Ski Lake.
Yes, that's correct. Out Ski Lake, on the east side of Ski Lake Road.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious, you know, what are the things over the winter months that you're looking for? Do we anticipate, when spring comes and the snow clears and you're able to actually get some monitoring out there, do you anticipate, you know, seeing the final map that was done in September, you know, was that going to change where the fire has actually moved under the snow and through the duff? And does that happen over the winter, or does it just kind of, how does it work?
It's a slow smolder. You know, we saw it on the Funny River fire. We saw it on the Card Street fire. It's a slow smolder. So I'm sure that there's some gain in acreage at some level. It's not going to probably move real far, but, you know, we saw a lot of deep burning this year too, a lot of ash pits, you know, deep ash pits, and we had several associated firefighter injuries due to those ash pit injuries and just deep burning. So, you know, we're anticipating, you know, we had drier conditions this year than we've really ever had before. So we're totally anticipating holdover fires, and, you know, the rain here that we received through the fall months certainly help. But when we see snow like this, it basically just covers and insulates, and that fire is just gonna chunk along and wait for next spring when the fire, you know, when the snow conditions go, and we may see some of that fire activity popping up as soon as April, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe even as soon as the snow goes, it could be earlier than that even.
And so for this fire and then in years past, is that something, you know, knowing that it's still going to be active in the spring, that you're monitoring, I'm sure, as soon as you can get, you know, shovels under the ground to put a hand down and see how hot it actually is. You know, are you moving, to use technical jargon, which we're not supposed to do, are you moving apparatus and equipment and staging things to potentially, you know, to potentially respond to something as it happens, as it gets unexpectedly hot and dry in a very short amount of time?
Yeah, we have a plan for that. You know, we have initial attack firefighters, you know, at our station.
At the ready,
That's our primary mission is look at any fire. This fire would be no different. We'd consider it a new fire, you know, come this next year. And any fire on the perimeter that's posing any sort of a threat, you know, we're anticipating to have folks out in that area, our initial attack resources, to do monitoring. And, you know, of course, the public is going to be probably a big factor in that too, because mushroom hunting is a big
That's right.
A big deal here, especially a fire like this. There's road accessible areas to get into. And just like we saw in the Card Street fire and the Funny River fire, several of our holdover fire reports came from the public, you know, so you know, we'll get a fair amount that way, but we do have plans with our initial attack forces to to patrol those areas on a regular basis. And we also have aviation assets that can assist with that as well.
And what do you suggest, you know, for folks who are out hunting for mushrooms and getting their early spring hikes in when they can? How do you like to try to get them to contact you or get information in? What's a good way to do that?
You know, we get a lot of our calls through 911. You know, our dispatch office is linked with 911 local office.
So people see smoke and call it in. Yeah.
Yep, correct. And we also have a fire line that people can call into, or our regular forestry office line. 260-4200 is our main line, and we get a lot of calls that way and direct it to our dispatch. But we encourage folks that they see something, you know, let us know. Now, I will say that, you know, in this fire situation, there's going to be a lot of fire burning interior, you know, so we're going to be focused primarily on the perimeter of the fire and closest to values at risk and potential for, you know, communities at risk. So if it's something that's out burning in the middle of the fire or, you know, towards the southern portion of the Ski Lack Loop where people can access that, that's going to be kind of in the middle portion of that fire.
Yeah.
And we're going to look at every fire call that we get and make a determination on if we need to put resources in there or not. And it's all going to be based on safety. You know, with this fire, because the fire did burn so deep, if you look at a spruce tree, the root system on a spruce tree is very shallow, so it only goes down just below the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And the surface being the duff layer, and with the duff burning as deep as it did this year, it was really easy for those trees to tip over with no wind. So a lot of the trees have come down, but that's another thing to probably throw out there for people that want to recreate come next spring, is the tree hazards that are out there.
Yeah.
Still. And also just the, you know, with the amount of trees that are on the ground, it's going to be like really arduous.
Yeah.
To get around in some of those areas. So
I did want to touch on that. And I know that maybe, Christy, this isn't necessarily your what you deal with day to day, but, you know, recognizing that that a lot of recreation areas in the refuge were affected. And as we mentioned, you know, Skyline Trail and some other trails used sort of as fire breaks. And what are some changes that folks might be looking at in terms of some of those recreation areas or things that they should be aware of if they're looking to go hiking in the spring, those sorts of things?
Well, sure. So Howie touched on some of the dangers, the perils that are out there right now.
A lot of weak trees.
Yeah, post-fire. So right now those areas are still closed. As you had mentioned, the Skyline Trail was used as a contingency line, so it was prepared by firefighters. Mm-hmm. Some of the overstory vegetation was removed. And then the fire did travel through that area, pushed by a dry cold front when it came through. So those areas where there's a lot of fire-weakened trees, and we want to keep the trees there when they fall over, they actually help to stabilize the soil. And because this fire burned so deep, a lot of those duff layers are gone now. So those trees are the future soil, if you think about them that way. So we would rather not remove all of the trees from, you know, from those areas, but where there is a specific trail itself, we have funding that we received from the National Office through the Burned Area Emergency Response, and a team came in the latter part of the fire and just assessed what was some of the damage created to the trail system, and so we've begun the repair on that. And one of the other perils is that there are trees stacked on top of trees, so we had professional firefighters, professional sawyers go in and remove some of those trees from those trails. That's going to be an ongoing process. Every snowfall, like the one we just had, every big rainfall, those fire-weakened trees are going to continue to fall. So that's going to be a hazard that folks should expect out in those areas. The ash pits are still active, at least this fall they will be, probably next spring. They'll be out there, they just won't be hot. So those are some of the things to be looking at. Mushroom hunters, look down, and the trees are coming from above, so that can really be a concern.
Yeah.
But for right now, those areas are going to remain closed because of those fire weekend trees.
Well, and there's getting to be a lot of snow up there anyway.
Yes.
You know, talking about the ash pits and the conditions that made those possible, you know, one of the things that is sort of, to me anyway, kind of in the background of how this fire played out is just this relentless dryness that nobody would expect in South Central Alaska, that you would go, you know, 8, 10, 12 weeks without really any significant rainfall. And at what point during the course of responding to this fire and you're seeing crews ramp up, at what point are, as fire managers, are you going, come on already, a little bit's fine, but this is this is getting to be too much?
I think there was a lot of that, actually. You know, we did see a little shot of precip towards the last week of July.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that kind of got us thinking that, you know, we're going to see our southwest flow, which is when we start seeing that southwest flow come, normally that just comes with, you know, precip on a regular basis, like every 2 or 3 days, you know, you see a shot of moisture. And I think that was really the difference in what we call the Swan Lake 2.0 when it stood up again in mid-August, is those rains never really came, you know, they never did. So that drought and our conditions just continued to dry and hit historic marks in our buildup indexes and our drought codes, our fuels, everything was a lot drier. You know, I know that's happened before here on the peninsula. I believe it was 1969 when the Kenai fire happened. That fire, it carried all the way through the summer. I think it started like the around the first week of August when that fire started.
And I didn't realize it started that late.
Yeah,
in the year.
I did. Yeah. Yeah, and it went all the way into October. You know, and there was not a lot of difference. You know, as far as how long it went this year with the Swan Lake fire, we hit the first week of October. Was the last incident management team that we had on the fire, and we got a nice map. I forgot to mention that earlier. You know, we put a nice map together of the heat that was still out there. So we have that on file. That plays into our plan of how we'll go and check those areas come springtime.
Historic drying. Yeah, it gives you a kind of a jumping off point for in the spring again when the snow is gone. You know exactly where to go to look and see what's changed, what's different. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Go ahead, Christy.
You know, so the Swanson fire in 1969, those that fly out of the Kenai Airport, you can see this large swath of mostly deciduous vegetation, a little bit of spruce mixed in, but pretty much it's largely birch, and there are areas of aspen as well. And that's an area that there's real diverse habitat. We see a lot of moose in that area. So if you think about the transition, the succession, forest succession of what happens post-fire, that is probably what we are looking at. Certainly not right away, right? Right away, right now we see is burnt forest out in the Swan Lake area. But if in 5, 10, 15 years, we're going to start seeing where those trees are laid over, those birch saplings, they're going to come up. And they're not going to be able to be accessed by animals until they get to be larger. So they'll actually have a chance to grow to maturity.
Right.
So I think we're going to see real similar landscapes, which is why a lot of us live here. We live here because we want to look out at these amazing, vast landscapes and appreciate, you know, the wilderness and the woods, the boreal forest, for what it is. And that's a diverse landscape, a different vegetation types.
Yeah. So. Well, and appropriate that, you know, that we're talking about the sort of the life cycle of a forest and building those soils up. I think World Soil Day was this week or last week. There was World Soil Day, and we know that that's something we don't have a ton of here on the Kenai Peninsula. We're such a geologically young place that having these natural processes take place develops those sorts of soils that will help us do, I don't know what, grow who knows what in the future. But we've got a few minutes left here on the Kenai Conversation. If you have a question, comment, concern regarding the Swan Lake Fire, fire management, 283-8414 is the number. Again, 283-8414. And, you know, in the last little bit here, I wanted to kind of zoom out a little bit and sort of take advantage of the combined, over 50 years of firefighting experience in the room that we have here, and just get both your thoughts. You know, we're seeing, it seems like, and maybe it just seems like, but between what we saw on the Kenai Peninsula, what we're seeing on the Kenai Peninsula, I should use the present tense, what we're seeing in California and other parts of the West, I'd like to get just kind of your two cents on sort of the world of Western wildland fires, and is it accelerating, changing? Are we prepared for the potentialities that are out there, those sorts of things? Howie, what do you think?
Well, just in my career, I can speak to what I've seen.
Sure.
It does seem like the season is getting longer. You know, we're having fire earlier in the year, and in some places now, like California, they don't even call it a fire season. It's all year round.
Right.
You know, and here we certainly have seen that too. You know, I think there's science that shows that, you know, our shoulder seasons, so spring and fall, are definitely getting longer. But you know, it's interesting because it's all relative. You know, we have these ebb and flows of you know, 10-year period of hot and dry, and then we go into this, we call it the decadal oscillation, you know, where we get these 10-year periods of warm and dry and then cool and wetter. And not that we're not going to have fire during the cool and wetter, but you know, we kind of have this interesting flow. But I definitely think there's something, you know, to be said for, you know, our season's getting longer and paying attention to that. And I believe it was I think it was around 2009 that the state of Alaska actually recognized that fires were starting earlier in the state, and so they moved the legal fire season, which I believe previously was May through August 31st, to start in April. So now it's April through August 31st.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, our director, our state forester, and others extended the fire season, you know, out beyond August. It went to August or September, the end of the month, September. So recognizing that we had this long drought condition, and we need to have enough firefighter staff to deal with the potential fire activity all the way through the fall months.
Yeah. And Christy, I'm especially curious, you know, from your position with a federal agency, you know, is there that same recognition at the federal level that the fire season is expanding and that there is more potential in a lot of places for these more extreme events?
Oh, absolutely there is, and staffing level is part of it. The other part of it is that we put out fires a lot adjacent to communities for obvious reasons. We don't want to impact the communities. So what's being looked at is where is it okay to have fire? You know, on years that, as this year was anticipated to be an average year, this would have been a perfect, had it been an average year and not an atypical hot, dry summer. You know, where we can have fire as a natural process to reduce fire risk adjacent to communities. That's something that we are looking at from the federal side, and I know the state side's looking at that as well. So it's more than just, you know, figuring out how can we put fires out. It's where can we have fire for the same, you know, same end. So, and that's to protect values.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, Howie.
Oh, I just had one other comment I wanted to make before we left. You know, we typically average around 60 fires a year for the Kenai Peninsula. This year we had 72, so we're above average. But you know, some of those came early. Obviously, April we started early, but we certainly had some larger fires even that people may not have known about. You know, the Tustamina Lake fire.
That's right.
127 acres.
Mm-hmm.
We also had the Caribou Lake fire down by Homer, which was over 800 acres.
Yeah.
Another fire down by Anchor Point on the North Fork Road that was right at 60 acres. So, you know, there's other fires out there that I think are worth mentioning. You know, I know the focus tends to be on the Swan Lake fire because it was certainly the biggest, the most, you know, forefront fire, kind of in your face fire. But there's a lot of other initial attack and successful mm-hmm. initial attack done, you know, in cooperation with our other agency partners and local cooperators like our fire department. So.
Well, and that sort of gets into that sort of classic question of, you know, do you put your resources into response or do you put your resources into prevention? And boy, oh boy, I'm sure we could spend a whole other hour trying to break that down and solve the world's problems from that angle. But we're just about out of time. And in just the minute or so that we have left, I just would like to, you know, closing thoughts or things that folks maybe should be aware of or be thinking about as we're in the winter months and thinking ahead to next summer and the potential for fires there. Christy?
Yes, absolutely. So when you think about living in a beautiful place like the Kenai Peninsula, it's amazing. It's this amazing, vast boreal forest. Boreal forest is flammable, and that's from natural forces such as lightning. Lightning will cause a wildfire. So it's a shared responsibility between federal agencies, which we're doing. We're doing mechanical fuel breaks, prescribed fire where we can allow fire to safely exist. So it's a shared responsibility for homeowners such as myself. I've firewised my two acres, and just look at our own properties and see where we can help reduce the risk to our own property. That's our responsibility.
Yeah. And Howie, closing thoughts?
And I would echo the same exact thing. You know, I mean, FireWise, that's a big portion of what we do in a prevention realm. We have a prevention side and we have an operation side. And we spend a lot of time trying to get that information out to the public. And it is. It's some ownership there that we really need to see more of, you know. And I would just encourage folks to really do an honest assessment of your property. And if you have questions about your property, or if you would like professional assistance or somebody to look at it, you know, we have those folks available to help with that as well. You know, we do home assessments and property assessments every year. So feel free to call, and we'll be happy to send somebody out in the spring. Probably not this time of the year when
right.
The snow's a little deep, but certainly in the spring.
Very good. Well, Howie Kent, Christy Bullock, thank you so much for being here this morning. Good to talk to you both.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much, Haylen. Appreciate it.